Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. The news is in, Boris Johnson will be permitting Huawei to build parts of the 5G network for the UK, however, be restricted to the non-core parts with other limitations involved. James, we discussed on the podcast yesterday how this was like to be an unpopular decision with lots of Tory MPs. In fact, that went on to be shown in the chamber when there was an urgent question by Tom Tugendhat. Do you think the government's attempt at a compromise solution where Huawei has access, but in a limited sense, is going to win some critics over?
Well, I think when you read of all the provisions that have been made to limit Huawei's involvement, you do wonder whether it's wise to have them involved in the first place. If you have to have all of these provisions in place to keep them away from the core of the network, to limit their involvement to no more than 35%, is it really sensible to be using them in the first place? And I think this 35% question is where Tory opinion will turn on. So at the, Dominic Raab implied in the statement that for this 35% was a cap that the government would hope to reduce over time. And if the aim is to get Huawei's involvement down from 35% to zero in, say, the next decade or two, then I think that will reassure a lot of people on the Tory side. But if this is going to be from 35% going down very, very slowly and still at kind of, you know, 25%, say, in a decade's time, I don't think that will be enough. I think people worry about two things. I mean, they worry about the role of Huawei and what that means in terms of China's access into the UK's 5G network. And I think they worry about the effect on the UK's most important security relationship, the Five Eyes. And I think there is a problem when you've got the US and Australia taking one position and the UK taking a different position. And I think my final concern is the UK makes this argument that basically GCHQ has been monitoring Huawei for years now. It has more expertise in dealing with this company than anywhere else in the world. But it has also sent a signal with this decision to other governments in the Western world that having Huawei involved in your 5G network is manageable. Now, it might be the case that the UK can manage it, but I doubt that many other countries have the capacity to manage it in the way that the UK is doing. So we might well be giving false comfort to some other countries that look at how much faster the Huawei, how much cheaper the Huawei equipment is, how it would enable you to roll out 5G much faster. And actually, they would be taking an even bigger security risk than we are because they don't have their own GCHQ or a version so advanced as we do.
Fraser, a US senator has likened the Prime Minister's decision to allowing the KGB to build a telephone network in the UK during the Cold War. Do you agree with that? And do you think that perhaps if you think along the lines of being suggested, which is that number 10 prioritise building infrastructure and digital over potentially a UK-US trade deal, this is a price worth paying?
Yeah, well, that was Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas, and he has been, for example, a few weeks ago, he introduced a bill which would ban US intelligence sharing with any countries that allowed Huawei technology. So there are some Republicans who see this as Britain's decision basically as a proxy for what's going to happen in other countries, in France and Germany. And Britain was supposed to be the Huawei domino. That if Britain could be persuaded to not let Huawei in for fear of compromising its relationship with the US, then other countries were likely to follow. The Americans worry now that we have decided to defy Uncle Sam over this, that everybody else is going to as well. Now, we also know with the Trump administration has been quite explicit that a trade deal will be a lot harder, given that we've taken the decision that we're taking. And I have to say that this aspect of it will go down quite well in Britain. There will be an aspect where you think, well, we don't like these Americans. They won't. We don't like their hectoring. We don't like their threats. We don't like the, we're going to, you better not dare to do this, otherwise we're going to punish you. And so I think that there's political capital, some kind to be gained there. But then again, you've got to ask whether the Americans have a point, and they certainly do. I wouldn't quite say it's like letting the KGB in. And there's all sorts of theories as to why this is going to be okay. There's a special laboratory in Oxford where apparently all the Huawei technology is going to be tested by British officials. And also the intelligence services, a good chunk of them actually, want this to go ahead because they believe they've got the ability to make sure that it's secure. They believe you can split this atom and have the Huawei cheapness and the Huawei technology without the Huawei security risk. Now, personally, I am less concerned about the security implications over this than I am about the diplomatic implications, because I think Trump probably will exert some kind of punishment at a time where we could do with American support. So we'll wait to see what the next few days bring. Boris might have thought to himself, well, let's face it, the Americans were never going to give us a trade deal that we could have got through Parliament anyway. So there is not very much lost here. We might get some brownie points for standing up to America, and your average British consumer will like cheap stuff, and 5G is cheap stuff. If you can download an episode of Friends in 3 seconds rather than in 4 minutes, which is what 5G does relative to 3G, then perhaps the Prime Minister's thinking that the punters will quite like that.
James, this seems to be, if you look at the reaction from Conservative MPs so far and the warnings in advance of the decision from across the party, the first truly unpopular decision that Boris Johnson has made since winning that majority of 80. How much political capital is he spending here?
I think he's spent quite a lot. This is the first decision he's taken since winning the election that has disappointed his own party. I think there is also, this is going to cause problems because I think the Lib Dems are onto this now. Labour are a bit slow off the mark on this. There's going to also become a human rights argument here, which is Huawei technology is a kind of key part of a Chinese surveillance state. And people will start saying, is this really the kind of company that the UK government should be doing business with, considering what some of its technology is being used for? So I think this decision is going to become unpopular on multiple fronts. But as Fraser says, what Boris Johnson is betting is that we will have discussions like this on this podcast and in the tea rooms of Westminster, people have these discussions. But what voters will notice is that they've got 5G faster than they had before. And I think one of the other really big things that swayed the decision in favour of allowing continued Huawei involvement is that if you'd wanted to take Huawei out, you'd basically have had to go backwards in terms of connectivity, so taking them out of various bits of the 4G network. And I think for a government that has made so much of kind of levelling up, of connecting the whole country to the digital economy, to basically reduce connectivity in places would have been very difficult. But what I sincerely hope is that the UK government is now working as rapidly as it can to get to a position where that 35% Huawei share can be reduced to zero. Because, I don't think there is an immediate... I think you can argue, as Fraser's saying, the intelligence services are confident they can deal with this now, right? It seems a fairly reckless bet to bet that you can stay half a step ahead of Huawei all the way. Is that really something you want to, given the resources that China puts into these things, is this really a gamble that you want to take, that for the next generation you can stay ahead of them in terms of what they are doing?
There's another political aspect to this. If I were a Remainer worried that Brexit meant that Britain was about to become the 51st state of America, I would take heart at this decision. This is a very important decision on Britain's positioning vis-a-vis US and Europe. And it has this decision says that Britain is striking an independent tone of both the EU and the US. So diplomatically, this is something which ought to cheer up those who had thought that Brexit will mean an American takeover of Britain, or that Britain was somehow joined NAFTA. I would love that, but ain't going to happen.
Meanwhile, when it comes to the government's in-tray of things they have to do, we've had a report today from the Migration Advisory Committee on what the government's future post-Brexit immigration system could look like. The committee has warned against the full points-based system which Boris Johnson suggested he wished to opt for during the German election campaign. James, what does this mean for the government's plans?
Well, it's not a binding report, and I think everyone expected the Migration Advisory Committee was not going to endorse the full points-based system. I think this government's position on immigration is becoming fairly clear, which is it's going to be much more liberal at the top end of things than Theresa May, but it's going to try and be much tighter at the bottom end of things. We've almost with an explicit aim of trying to raise wages for certain jobs in the UK. I suspect that they will go for a point system rather than a salary threshold. But remember, there's no reason why you can't award points for wanting to come and work in a profession where we do not have enough people who want to do it. So there's no reason why a point system could not, for example, give someone points for wanting to work in the social care system. So this debate isn't quite as binary as people think. And it's also worth remembering that point style systems are generally used by countries that are quite happy with quite high levels of immigration.
Fraser, the report today from the Migration Advisory Committee suggests that the current £30,000 threshold for immigrants to this country is reduced to around £25,600, to be precise. Is that a measure you would agree with, or do you think they should be removing a financial threshold altogether?
Well, I would like to see it far lower. I think the 30 grand threshold was disgusting, actually. I remember, you know, at the time, sort of high-skilled people we were deporting because they didn't meet Theresa May's salary threshold. It was one of the reasons that made me reluctantly support Brexit. Because, of course, if we want to control the numbers of immigration, and you can't control EU immigration, the only tools you've got left is to come down really hard on non-EU migrants in a way which really does make it very hard to get a job in this country. Say you're a Kenyan computer programmer, for example. It's difficult unless you're going to start on 30 grand. 25 grand is an improvement, but I still think the notion of a salary threshold just basically ought to go. Britain has coped amazingly well with a massive influx of immigration over the last few years. It's made us one of the most successful, perhaps the single most successful melting pot in Europe. And I've always thought that the problem is not that Britain is full, Britain can handle more people, you know, a huge amount of this. There's lots of space left in this country. It's how you do it, and are you doing it in a way which is fair? So I think with the Migration Advisory Committee, the clue's in the name. It's just advice. It doesn't really matter what they think of a points-based system. Priti Patel will introduce whatever she wants to, whatever the Prime Minister wants her to do. But we also know the general theme of it, that this is going to be, if you're a NHS worker, if you're going to be a sort of scientist, then pretty much anybody can come to Britain. That's the message they want to send out. But if you're going to be a builder or a sort of agricultural worker, then that's going to be more difficult. And in a way, quite right too, because there are sectors of our economy that have completely changed their business model to take advantage of immigration. Take the food processing sector, for example. In 2004, I think 2% of people in that sector were EU migrants. Now it's closer to 30%. So they've completely changed their model in importing labour rather than investing in technology, which has kept wages down. So we've got too many people doing jobs that computers and machines should be doing. Hopefully that's about to change. But the Migration Advisory Committee will only be a small part, I think, of that solution.
James, when it comes to the effect that a new immigration system is going to have on the economy, it's clear that big businesses would prefer to have flexibility on the system and freer ability to bring in workers from other countries. But yet one of the fights Number 10 not even seems happy to have, but is quite ready to have, is this idea that they want to clamp down on it. So do you think economic arguments hold that much weight with Number 10 when it comes to how they plan the system?
I refer you to the blog you wrote some hours ago. I think your analysis there is correct, which is that the government is quite happy to have big business and CBI complaining about the migration regime at the lower end of the wage scale, because I think they think that that is a message to voters that you know, the migration that actually bothers people, that people think has a negative effect on their wages, is going to be vastly reduced. And I think that what the compensating factor that Number 10 will pursue is it will become much, much easier to hire talented people from the rest of the world, from outside the EU, than it was before. And you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, if you have a PhD in computer science and you want to move to the UK, there's probably never been a better time to do it.
The funny thing about free movement is that the Migration Advisory Committee once did a report showing that the effect of it was to reduce the salaries of the low paid by 5% and increase the salaries of the high paid by 10%. Now, that's a very revealing figure. And it also goes to show why the well-off were probably quite with it economically justified. Well, put it this way, it probably shows why the well-off were more likely to argue for free movement. It was a system which made top salaries higher. It also showed it was why it was far less popular amongst those who are facing the competition. There's no doubt it's had a hugely distortive effect on wages, but it has benefited the rich more than the poor. And it's one of the things I've changed my mind off in recent years. There haven't been many, but I used to be a big liberal in immigration control. I used to wish there was no border control at all. And I came to realise that that's really easy for me to say, because it basically, the system of immigration control has expanded my horizons, it's made my opportunities multiply, but it has made things tougher for those who live on the other end of a district line to me. And you basically want to do globalisation in a way that brings with it more public consent, and that's what Brexit's all about.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And while we have you here, I'm going to plug an event you may have heard of before, and that's our event which is it time to offer amnesty to Britain's illegal immigrants? Which is a debate, including input from Fraser Nelson, Kate Andrews, our new economics correspondent, and David Goodhart of Policy Exchange. And I will also now be chairing that event.
Yay.
So in case you just couldn't hear that because the microphone wasn't turned on, that was Fraser cheering in the background. To grab a ticket to this event while stocks last, please do go to www.spectator.co.uk/amnesty podcast. And just to give you some specifics about that event, it's on the 25th of February, which is a Tuesday. It starts at 7 p.m. It finishes at 8:15 p.m. and it is at the Emmanuel Centre in Westminster.